The third case for oral argument this morning is Purdue, Inc. and others, appellants versus M. Michael Rounds, governor of the state of South Dakota and others, appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Gary Jensen, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellees, we have Ms. Patricia Archer, an attorney from Pierre. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself on this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Stephen Jensen, circuit judge from the First Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Zinner's place. Mr. Jensen, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thanks. May it please the court.
Counsel.
I represent Purdue Manufacturing, the Purdue family, who asked the court to declare the purchase agreement executed by the state of South Dakota and sellers in Rapid City. The agreement that was executed in March of 2009, we asked that it be declared null and void because it violated what's been referred to as House Bill 1271. So the focus first today is House Bill 1271. Section 9 states, prior to purchasing any property with the proceeds of revenue bonds described in Section 1, the Secretary of the Department of Corrections shall conduct public meetings to solicit input from and share information with citizens, business owners, and school administrators located within 2 miles of the property to be purchased.
Is that theory based then on because they didn't follow the law, then they have no authority? Is that the...
Because they didn't follow the law, the contract they entered into is null and void.
And that's the only possible remedy?
It's the only possible remedy that we know of. It was the only possible remedy tried to the circuit court. In other words, if you violate the statute, anything that flows from that conduct is null and void. It's unenforceable.
When did that bill become law?
In the 2009 legislative session, the governor signed it. I don't remember exactly the date.
March 12th,
I think, is the right date.
So did it become law then, or did it become law ordinarily when we say post enactments become law July 1st?
I think for our purposes, it became law then. It was intended that it became law when the governor signed it.
Wasn't an emergency enactment, though, was it?
It was not.
Does the law prescribe any consequences if the hearing had been held? What was to be done with that input? Or the secretary just have to go through the motions?
Well, the statute, House Bill 1271, does not set out specifically criteria that is supposed to be considered during these public meetings.
So we overturn under your argument because he didn't hold the hearing, but if he held the hearing and just totally ignored everything they were saying, he could proceed with the purchase.
I don't think so.
What can he do?
I think that implied in this situation, in any situation, is that the state, the government, has to act in good faith, and they have to give legitimate consideration to what the public has to say. And we don't have to guess about what these considerations should be. They're well known. There's industry standards on what applies to where you put prisons and the considerations that you should take. In fact, I forget what exhibit it is, but the department itself, after we offered alternatives called the Rausch Building and another alternative, went through an internal review or examination, and they had a list of, I think, 2 or 3 pages of standard factors and considerations that they or anybody else looking at putting a prison should take into account. And the building that we suggested, which was never really considered, scored essentially equally, even in the department's own internal evaluation. So the legislature doesn't say have public input before you do something just on a wink and a nod so you can have a fair trial and hang them so it doesn't make any difference. Certainly the legislature intends that there be meaningful consideration, good faith consideration, and there's, like I say, you could just Google it. Wherever you want to look, there are industry standards that people considering the placement of prisons should look at and the legislature would intend that they do that.
I'm not sure then exactly what remedy you're seeking from this court. Are you asking us to just nullify the purchase, or are you asking us to remand and order the secretary to hold a hearing? What do you want?
What I want, what we want, is this purchase agreement to be declared null and void. Sale has to be undone. It didn't happen, shouldn't have happened. And if they want to proceed, the state has to go back and comply with House Bill 1271, which is have these hearings and give legitimate, good faith consideration to what the public says.
Can I go back to the question about when this became law?
Sure.
You said you thought it became law when the governor signed it, which would be March 12th. But the purchase agreement was signed a week earlier, on March 4th.
Right.
Isn't that right? And you're saying that's when the violation occurred. So how do we enforce a bill that had not been enacted at the time that it would, do you say the purchase took place?
Well, because I think everybody here agrees that the bill applies to this contract. Nobody has ever suggested that it didn't.
But isn't it a is it a jurisdictional question whether we can enforce a bill that was not enacted into law at the time you're saying the violation occurred? It's not a, there's nothing in their language that says it's to be retroactive.
No, but the whole purchase agreement was conditioned on this House bill. House Bill 1271, it was referred to in the purchase agreement. Everybody understood that that was one of the conditions, and once it was passed, it became part of this agreement. So for our purposes, it became effective when the governor signed it.
Right, but the bill, the purchase that you say was a violation of the bill happened a week before the governor signed it on March 8th or 7th. So how do we say there's a violation here when there was no statute, there was no law to violate at the time the purchase took place?
Well, but there was a contract in place, and it was conditioned on the passage of this bill. So it was contemplated. What happened here is exactly what was contemplated and agreed to by the parties. So there was a contract.
I know there was a contract. I'm just wondering if there's a law.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was a law.
After
it was working its way
after
the
contract was signed. I mean, the purchase was signed. The purchase agreement was signed a week earlier, and then the governor enacts a law setting conditions for the purchase agreement. But the purchase agreement had already been signed. You're saying that's when the purchase took place. The state is saying it took place sometime later, but you're saying it took place a week before the bill became law.
The state says that a purchase didn't take place until the money exchanged hands,
right,
which was
right.
Months and months later.
Well,
go ahead.
The purchase wasn't a defined term in the bill, or so. Why wouldn't the time of closing, when a deed is signed and a consideration is exchanged, why wouldn't that be the date of purchase?
Because under every law we could find, whether it's Black's Law Dictionary or any case, they all define a purchase as a time when there's a binding agreement to pay an agreed upon price.
All right, then. Does the statute become ambiguous because it states that there has to be notice given to people within 2 miles of the proposed location? How would you get to that point if you're saying that's identified at the time of purchase and the purchase takes place prior to? You have to have notice prior to people within 2 miles. How does that work under your scenario?
Well, I think there are a number of ways that it could work. One way is, if somebody wanted this particular property, if the department wanted this particular property, you could purchase an option to purchase. And then everybody that is interested in this particular property could come and have their hearing and get public input like they're supposed to do. So you have an option to purchase. Or in this circumstance, there were 60 or 70 other alternatives. There were never hearings held on those. But if there were 3 or 4 potential places, then you can have options to purchase on all of those locations. So you can define the area other than by purchasing the property. That's the whole point of this. Why would the legislature, the whole point of this, House Bill 1271, was to reject Elk Vale because the public got angry, like they had been angry before, including they weren't angry at a spot about half a block away from where we're at today. That was rejected in 2007. So the whole point of this was to give the public an opportunity to give input before a final decision was made. And that obviously didn't happen. But I hope I answered your question. To get to the location, you just have to buy an option to purchase the property. There are a lot of reasons that the legislature would say you need to have public input. They wanted citizens to have input. Well, you can imagine all the reasons that the citizens would want to have input about a prison. Business owners. The Purdues came here because they got the protection from their heavy industrial district. That's very important to them. That's one of the main reasons we're here today. They proposed putting a prison in a heavy industrial district, which is absolutely incompatible with heavy industrial operations. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a prison or a dorm or an apartment. You don't want people next to heavy industrial. We can't find one other place in the country, not one, where this has been done.
This bill,
for the obvious reasons.
This bill, the state acquires real property here and there on occasion, so
yes.
They must have some legal authority to buy property. Isn't the significance of this bill a funding mechanism for that purchase rather than the authority to purchase?
I don't think so. I mean, the whole point of this bill was to say, you want a prison and you want to do it with revenue bonds? That's fine. Here's the authority for the revenue bonds. But before you take a place, before you pick a place, you have to ask the public.
Well,
that's the whole point of Section 8 is public input before you make a decision.
Say the Department of Corrections had the money in the bank, so they didn't need this bill. Did they have the legal authority, if they had the cash, to go out and buy this property?
Not according to this bill. If they were going to proceed.
Cite the bill. Do they have the legal authority, because if they got the cash, to go buy the property?
I don't think so. Not under these circumstances. Not when you're talking about this subject, this prison, and not with regard to this bill.
Are there any other criteria in South Dakota statutes about where prisons should be placed, or any other criteria that governs building or purchasing or anything like that? Is this it?
I don't think there are. I mean, it's certainly none have come up in any of our discussions and litigation back and forth.
Well, luckily we haven't been building a lot of prisons.
Yeah, right. So, this morning in the first case, Chief Justice Gilbertson said, we all have to be concerned about the effect of the case that we're talking about, not only for this case, but the rest of the state and other subjects looking forward. Well, that's one of the reasons we're here. After the fact, already a done deal, public input is not public input. Even Judge Fuller said in the trial court that the spirit of the law was violated. He said it four times. We tried to convince him.
Do you contest the need for a prison in the Rapid City area, or just you don't want it going right next door to your client?
We've never contested the need for a prison. In fact, I was thinking earlier, if the Purdue property is where you're sitting, there's been a temporary facility across a drainage ditch where I'm standing. It's been there since 2004. Purdue Manufacturing has never objected. In fact, they've hired people at this prison to be good citizens. Everybody agrees Purdue's good citizens. Everybody agrees that their concerns here are very legitimate. But now, the new prison.
We're on the internet, so you got to be by the mic.
Oh, sorry. But the new site is back in your office. So the problem is, back there is heavy industrial. And back there, everybody's going to have to walk by Purdue and their heavy industrial operations. So that's one of the reasons that we're here, is because in order to get back into Rapid City over here, instead of coming from here, now they have to go by the Purdue operations. And but Purdue's aren't
client,
here.
Yeah, and your client is worried that these prisoners will be filing lawsuits against him because they may be impaired in the because of the dust, the noise, whatever.
Right. I mean, even though Purdue's always have, and I'm sure always will, comply with all the environmental laws and things like that, their operations are good. Everybody agrees to that. But yes, you know, we asked how many times has the state been sued by the prisoners, and it was a couple hundred. I mean, it was a lot. And I think everybody would agree that that's a litigious population, if you will. And so they're concerned about frivolous lawsuits, and they're concerned about traffic. There's all sorts of traffic that goes up and down. This cannot be, I mean, the whole point of this was so the public could have input. Twice the legislature had said, no, you can't put it there, even though you've already, the Department of Corrections wanted it there, had an agreement to put it there. It can't be there. We're rejecting it because the public doesn't want it. The whole point of this statute was to say, listen to the public before you do something. Yet, after that contract was signed, in emails, the secretary said, it's a done deal. He had public meetings where he said, it's a done deal. I'm not going to consider alternatives. And he started hiring people to work on it. That is after the fact, already a done deal. Public input, which is no input at all. And certainly that's not the message that anybody should send out to state government or any level of government.
Don't you really need, though, to put a specific proposal on the table for discussion, or you're just talking about theory at the hearing? If you're having a public hearing, don't you say, well, we're thinking about putting the site out there next to Purdue's. What's your reaction to that? If you're just saying we're thinking about putting a prison somewhere around Rapid City, how do you comment on that?
I think you could probably comment however you put it out there, but like we talked about before, if you have one proposed location or two or three, yeah, have a hearing and talk about those one, two, or three proposed alternatives. And if you want to, quote, tie up the property, buy an option to purchase. Don't purchase it, because then it's a done deal. In the spirit and the letter of this statute is violated. You know, one of the best pieces of evidence that this was, these hearings were a sham, frankly. And one of the best pieces of evidence of that is that the seller sued for specific performance, and when you read, when we gave you that complaint, they said there was a binding purchase entered into in March of 2009. So the secretary thought it was binding. It was a purchase. The sellers did. And every bit of law we could find said the same thing. A purchase agreement, a binding agreement to pay agreed upon price is a purchase, which violates the statute that says prior to purchasing, you have to have public meetings.
When were the revenue bonds from the proceeds of the revenue bonds, when were they paid from the state to the seller?
I don't think, Judge, they've ever been issued. I mean, in part because of this lawsuit, I'm sure, but also in part because of financial considerations and all the uncertainty and budget issues. But there's no question. From the very beginning, and you'll see in the transcripts, the state has never taken the position that House Bill 1271 doesn't apply to this. They've agreed that it's applied to this. Everybody's agreed that it applies to this. It's central to what brings us here today. And another thing that is particularly significant, the state, the only legal authority the state can find for its position are two dictionaries. They didn't give you any case law that says what happened here is okay. The only legal authority, if you will, that they could present were two dictionaries, and the language from those two dictionaries has been used by the case law that we cited saying what happened here is a purchase. The other thing that has not been disputed by the state of South Dakota. Didn't even address it in their brief. Our point is, House Bill 1271 was violated, therefore this contract is null and void, and therefore the sale cannot exist. It's null and void. There's a whole long line of case authority that we cited, I think pages 25 to 26 in our brief, standing for that proposition. When the state or any other level of government violates bidding requirements or other contract or other statutory requirements, any contract is null and void. It cannot exist. The state didn't contest that. They don't contest that.
Your time has expired, Mr. Jensen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Archer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I think the issue of whether the Department of Corrections complied with House Bill 1271 is moot, and apparently the legislature thinks so too. Earlier this month, the legislature enacted Senate Bill 53, and through that enactment, it granted to the Department of Corrections $3.8 million in special appropriations to fund the renovation phase of this project. Now, as I indicated in my supplemental brief, it is simply inconceivable, especially given this budget climate, that the legislature would have done so if the department didn't comply with 1271.
Is this in lieu of the revenue bonds or in addition to?
I'm sorry?
Is this additional funding in lieu of the revenue bonds from the original bill, or is it in addition to?
I think it's in addition to. This was a special appropriation specifically.
So the requirements of the original bill are still out there.
Well, here's the situation with that. The original bill talked about the, you know, issuing revenue bonds for the purchase and ultimate renovation of this facility. But the facts have changed significantly since July 1st of last year when that House bill became law. And I believe it was not an emergency piece of legislation at all, so it became effective on July 1. 2009.
So how do we enforce it then if it didn't become law until July 1st and the contract was signed in March of earlier? How do we enforce this as law?
Well, frankly, that was something the state raised in its brief.
Oh, you did, Ray. I didn't see that. I thought I was being a little unfair to Mr. Jensen because I didn't see it raised. But you say it was raised?
Yeah, there's a point, and it was kind of in response to his position that if this purchase occurred in March of 2009, as is his position, then the House Bill 1271, which did not go into effect until July 1st, doesn't even apply. And I made that point, or at least I pointed out that there would be an entire question whether it would even apply because statutes are not to be applied retroactively.
Is that a jurisdictional question, do you think, or what is that? What category does that come under?
Well, I think it's just a matter of, I mean, this court would have to follow its, I would urge the court to follow its precedent saying it does not apply a statute retroactively unless the legislature specifically said so, and it did not in this case. The other question that I think Justice Gilbertson asked about was what authority did the Secretary of the Department of Revenue have to even sign that contract? He had absolute unfettered authority to do that in March or any other time of the year. And that is under SDCL 1-15-10, which specifically grants the department the authority to enter into contracts for many things, including the purchase and lease of land. That's the authority for signing the contract. That contract was legal the day it was signed.
So the bill is just a funding mechanism for the revenue bonds.
I believe so, yes. And now it's here we have the situation where bonding has not occurred, hasn't even started. I would hazard a guess that given the existence of this pending litigation, it would be extremely difficult for any bonding authority to even sell these bonds on the secondary market.
If it's just a funding authority, then the title certainly belies that because it says it's an act to authorize the purchase, design, construction, etc. So it's certainly more than just a funding bill, according to the title.
But the whole purpose of this, and again, you know, starting back from the whole, the history behind this, is to give the building authority would actually issue the bonds, but to get that building authority funding mechanism in place. Again, at the time of trial, certain facts were in play. But subsequent to the trial, other things had happened, and now, you know, we have a situation where, first and foremost, the department has now acquired that property.
Have they paid for it?
Pardon?
Have they paid for it?
They acquired it pursuant to a settlement of the specific performance litigation. And so, no, bonds were not used to acquire that property.
But money has exchanged hands. So.
Absolutely, yes. Okay. The settlement damages were paid to the seller, and the property was transferred. Title was transferred. Possession was transferred.
So then, this bill that you say was just enacted that makes things moot. Where does that money? What was that to reimburse the Department of Corrections or
the money of this bill?
This session, yes.
Oh no. This new bill, Senate Bill 53. And this session is a specific special appropriation to renovate this project. It was passed overwhelmingly with an emergency clause.
This is the renovation bill. The last one was the purchase bill. Okay.
The original bill, 1271, had the renovation component in it as well. But clearly, the bill that came up this session is a renovation bill.
Well, you're saying that 11510 gives you the statutory authority to buy the land, and you now say that you've paid for the land out of other funds not appropriated by 1271, are you saying 1271 is in essence a nullity?
I don't know what else to call it. I mean, again, at the time of trial, there were certain facts that were in play, and we felt, you know, we were proceeding and we were trying that case. But you know, things have happened since then, and I don't know how else to read it. Certainly, if the court thinks it still is in play and you know, we need to address the merits, I'm certainly willing to do that and prepared to do that.
So are you in agreement then that the definition of purchase, then they really purchased it when they entered into that purchase agreement, because evidently in light of the specific performance lawsuit and so forth, the state must have agreed then that they had committed to purchasing it under the agreement?
Well, two different things going on, and one is something, the specific performance lawsuit that's not before this court. You know, in something like that, the rights and remedies of those parties are at issue, and certain law applies to those, you know, to those matters.
Well, if it's purchased, though, that should apply to both, isn't it? The definition of when you purchased it, doesn't that apply to both?
I'm not sure it does, Your Honor. And again, I don't want to argue, you know, the specific performance suit. But the issue there, was there a commitment? I think the Secretary absolutely believed he had committed to buying this property. I don't really think that's a question. The question, though, is for purposes of this bill and in the context of a real estate transaction, did a purchase occur when the contract was signed in March of 2009? And the state would submit that it did not. And the reason is just based on fundamental principles of real property law, as well as what did and did not happen in March of 2009 when that agreement was signed. First of all, you look at the face of the purchase agreement itself. There were stated contingencies in that agreement that obviously had not yet occurred the day it was signed. We've got the funding by the legislature. You've got the appraisal, survey, title work, and any objections by the state that might have to be waived. All of these contingencies had yet to occur. And in fact, if any of those contingencies eventually had not been satisfied, the whole purchase wouldn't even have happened. The second thing you look at is that none of the incidents of ownership occurred on the day the purchase agreement was signed. You did not have possession by the department. In fact, there was no right to possession at all, you know, barring some other side agreement. You had no consideration exchanged. No deed was delivered. The department did not acquire title to this property. And you had no shift in the burdens of the property, such as the passing of risk of loss, the proration of taxes, the kinds of things you see at a closing, frankly, is where typically you see those kinds of things.
So you equate purchase with transfer of ownership?
Equate with, again, in the context of real estate transactions, it's the whole totality of the circumstances. I mean, all these incidents of ownership that happen, you know, that's when you consider this a purchase of the real property. The execution of this contract was just simply the memorialization of the agreement of the parties. It was not the purchase. And if you consider those fundamental concepts, and again, you can look at the case law, but the kind of cases that the plaintiff has cited don't really aid this decision. And that is because there's a lot of different cases that have to do with, you know, the purchase of personal property, the execution of a contract for deed, which is a totally different kind of animal. And so you just look at the plain and ordinary meaning of this word in the context of a real estate transaction, and you see that the purchase did not occur in March of 2009. To the extent there is any question about that, then you look behind the language, the bare language, at the context in which this bill was passed, the legislative history, and the purpose of the bill. And during the first argument, there was discussion about what was the purpose of this bill, and specifically Section 8. And clearly, Section 8 says the department shall conduct these meetings to solicit input from and share information with the public. And it wasn't just the public in general. It was certain members of the public within a two-mile radius of the property to be purchased. That is language from the bill. So, you know, it wasn't just a general pronouncement of, hey, I think you should, because you're looking at 70 potential sites, conduct a public meeting for all of these sites. It wasn't language that said, department, you know, you need to conduct public meetings for the public at large, for the public in Pennington County, or even, frankly, for the members of the public in Rapid City. It didn't say that. It said to conduct the public meeting for the citizens within 2 miles of the property to be purchased. There's a reason the legislature chose that. That's because they knew that the site had already been selected and that there's a need to have this meeting so the public in that discrete area could have the ability to give input about the project.
Let's assume, just for purposes of my question here, that we do determine that that property had been purchased by that agreement. And what does that, and that this statute or this House Bill 1271 applies to the proceeding, what's the remedy? Do you agree that does it all hinge on purchasing, or are there other remedies other than voiding the contract or voiding the agreement?
Frankly, Your Honor, as plaintiff has indicated, that is the remedy they sought, was to void the contract. So, you know, the trial court decided that issue and decided in favor of the state and said it was not void. But if this court were to consider that and decide that the contract was void, frankly, I don't know how this transaction can be undone.
Well, I get, okay. So what you're saying, that is, that's not even a remedy. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know how it would be undone. I mean, you've got a situation somewhat, probably unique and unusual, and certainly distinct from any of the cases that plaintiff cited about void contracts. They simply don't apply. They don't apply. They were governed by contracts that were based that were governed by statutes that specifically declared them to be null and void if all requisites of the statute weren't complied with. The Conflict of Interest Statute 611 and also the Competitive Bidding Statute 151819. They have specific language that declares these contracts to be void. So all that case law just simply doesn't apply here.
I'm looking at Section 8, trying to interpret the intent of the legislature. The first sentence says, prior to purchasing any property, with the proceeds of the revenue bonds described, and then it goes on. So you're saying the revenue bonds are not going to be used, correct? So are, is it your position that because of that, this clause is meaningless at this point?
I could tell you this, Your Honor. I could tell you that the property was not purchased with the proceeds of revenue bonds. You know, what may happen in the future, I mean, what I know is the revenue bonds have not been issued, aren't planned on being issued at this point, and we've got this other special appropriations bill that is, that's out there to renovate the project.
Why was the secretary in such a hurry to sign the purchase agreement in this case? I mean, is there anything in the record that said there are other potential buyers out there? Was there a date that said you got to buy it by this, you got to sign the agreement by this date? I mean, why was it that the timing, is there anything in the record that explains that?
I don't know that the record indicates that there are other potential buyers that we're aware of. However, it's clear that the secretary felt that this was a good deal. He had agreed purchase price with these sellers of $2.2 million, and he wanted to lock it in. And as it turned out, his thinking was borne out because that appraisal came back at $3.1 million. Okay? So, and that's one reason. Another reason is, you know, once this got out, that this property was for sale, he had now locked in the sellers from, frankly, getting into a bidding war to up the price. Another reason is to foreclose the seller from essentially backing out, getting cold feet, you know, based on some of the negative reaction, you know, to building a correctional facility, which inevitably happens. And finally, there's just nothing in the bill or in any other statute that requires him to wait and hold off. There's just nothing in the bill that would have required him to take a different course. So. The state's interpretation.
So I just have one more question on the revenue bonds so that I understand. So section one of the bill, assume this is the act, the bill, that authorizes the up to $6 million. The South Dakota Building Authority may finance up to $6 million. You're saying that never transpired.
That's correct.
And it isn't anticipated to transpire, or what's the deal?
Again, I don't know what may or may not happen in the future, but I do know what's before us right now.
So this bill, nothing's happened with it. Is that what you're saying? The authority that they give the South Dakota Building Authority to issue these bonds to finance it up to $6 million has never been implemented?
That's correct. That part is correct. What has happened under this bill, obviously, is that the department did hold the public meetings. And the state would submit entirely in conformance with this bill.
Under 115.10, is there any requirement for public hearings?
No, there's not, Your Honor. Bottom line is that the department complied with this bill. The trial court found and declared that the department had complied with this bill, and the state would urge this court to do the same. If there's no more questions, I'll end my time.
Thank you. No one's ever chastised for quitting early. Mr. Jensen, you have 10 minutes.
If you look at the purchase agreement, there were three contingencies: passage of House Bill 1271, survey, and appraisal. Standard contingencies, except for the 1271. And I think if we looked at all the real estate law, people have an implied obligation of good faith to make sure they do what they can do to have those contingencies come into reality. And they did. Before the first public meeting, all those contingencies had happened. So by April 29th, none of those contingencies were an issue.
You said something, I don't know if I caught it right. You're saying that one of the things in the purchase agreement was the contingency that 1271 had to be passed into law?
Yes. And, of course, that had happened on March 12th, I think you pointed out
right
earlier.
How about the fact that they're not using, as the state is saying, that they haven't used any of this authority to issue or finance it through revenue bonds?
That's a very good point. It's a very good question, and it's critical to this, and we raised it very early on. I can't tell you what page of the transcript, but there's a discussion back and forth between myself and the lawyer for the state where I wanted to make darn sure that 1271 applied to these proceedings, that they weren't going to argue that something it doesn't apply. I can get you after it because I don't know today. But they agreed specifically that House Bill 1271 applied to this process. And the only problem was, and probably still exists, is they didn't know how many of these bonds, how much of the $6 million in bonds was going to be required because of all of the uncertainty with regard to the budget and this and that. So there's never been any question from the beginning. House Bill 1271 applies to this.
It seems, though, it's very much tied to the issuing of bonds, even the very language of the section that you rely on, Section 8. It's prior to purchasing any property with the proceeds of the revenue bonds described in Section 1. Doesn't that limit your purchasing any property argument that if they decided to purchase the property or in the hindsight went ahead and purchased the property with general funds money, then I don't know how Section 8 applies?
Well, it applies only because, and I think that's the point of the agreement that I think is in the record, these revenue bonds are going to be used, and it's not just for the purchase. I mean, as Justice Konenkamp mentioned in the title, I mean, House Bill 1271 deals with the purchase, the renovation, the equipment, and all of that. And so how they exactly decide what money's going to be used on the purchase, what money's going to be used on renovating, what money's going to be used on different parts of it, that I think still is up in the air because of all the uncertainties with regard to the budget. But the stipulation was, no question about it, this bill applied because some part of these revenue bonds were going to be used in some part of this project, whether purchase or renovating. The other, couple other points. The fact that they've closed should really have no meaning here whatsoever. That would then be to bless some level of government saying, go ahead, avoid the law, but close it, transfer the money, and then because you've done it, we'll have to excuse the violation of the statute. That can't be the law. It's not right. And again, if you look at the record, there was a very specific discussion amongst everybody in that courtroom, including Judge Fuller, that said, well, if you close, you're closing at your own risk, knowing that if this was a purchase and it violated 1271, this was null and void. The state has never suggested any other remedy. There is no other remedy. If you violate state statute when you enter into a contract, that contract is null and void. Never existed. Can't exist. And you can't avoid that by pretending that you've closed the transaction. Last point, Senate Bill 53 doesn't mention House Bill 1271. It doesn't mention this transaction. It doesn't bless what happened in 2009. There is no way. Even reading newspapers about what people were saying in the press, you cannot look at House Bill or Senate Bill 53 and say it in any way blesses what we're here to talk about. It doesn't even mention it. It mentions generically renovating a prison in Rapid City. Doesn't mention purchase. Doesn't mention American Concrete, this property. It doesn't mention it at all. And in fact, as we put in our supplemental brief, if you think about it, if Senate Bill 53 is designed to piggyback, if you will, on what's already happened, then you have the legislature essentially spending good money after bad, which is a violation of the South Dakota Constitution. the legislature cannot authorize appropriate money to spend on a project if the underlying project is null and void because it violated statute. It could not be clearer. The whole point of House Bill 1271 was to say, given the history, given the fact that we, the legislature, have specifically rejected two other sites, before you're going to build a prison in Rapid City, before you buy property, you have to have a public hearing to solicit input. Under any definition of purchase, this purchase agreement was a purchase. Secretary thought so, said so, acted like it was. Sellers had specific performance. The state said, yeah, we did. Ms. Archer just said the secretary absolutely believed he committed to buy it in March of 2009. And that's what he said at the public hearings and in his emails. It's absolutely clear. And the state agreed that 1271 applied to this. And just because there's some uncertainty as to how much of these bonds are going to be used, it doesn't affect anything. At some point, some part of these bonds are going to be used in this project. That's what the state's agreed to. So, for all the reasons that we've talked about, unless you have other questions.
I guess not. Thank you, Mr. Jensen.
Thank you.
And I just want to say I appreciate your putting all of this in the appendix.
Oh, thank you.
We will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.